which is young people's geographies, or what I call young people's geographies. And in terms of what Katrina said at the start, it's just struck me that although most of my work, well, all of my work tends to be in the contemporary period, so I tend to talk about the here and now rather than looking historically. But actually, I've also got an edited collection on children, young people, and critical geopolitics, and some of that's about how young people are tied up and interconnected with geopolitical issues, which, and a lot of the geopolitics literature tends to ignore children and young people and look at elite state actors and international boundaries and all that sort of stuff, so we wanted to challenge that, so that might be available. And also, quite some time ago, did some work with unaccompanied asylum-seeking children who fled persecution and arrived in Scotland, and this was work with the Scottish Refugee Council, and part of that did look back to their experiences of war and their experiences of fleeing persecution and seeking asylum and trying to rebuild their lives in Scotland, so some of that might be of relevance as well. But what I'd like to say today, but that's just a kind of an aside, is about thinking through some of the kind of issues and that you might want to think about when it comes to involving young people in research. So again, some of this might not necessarily be relevant in terms of looking historically, but it might be relevant if you're wanting to engage young people with historical materials, if that makes sense. So a lot of these comments are about sort of ethical and methodological reflections. And one thing that I think is useful to think about is whenever, because sometimes what people say to me is they say, but they're a child, should we not do this? Or, you know, should we not, you know, the kind of assumptions people have about children and young people. So, like, one assumption is that children like to draw and we should give them a sheet of paper and a pen. You know, it's a bit like if I all gave you a sheet of paper and a pen and said, well, can you draw a picture? Probably three quarters of you would want to leave, simply. And I think a lot of children like that as well. The idea that all children like to draw, I'm kind of like, you know, some children quite like it, but quite a lot of them probably don't. And so quite often I find myself saying, oh, well, you know, do you think you would say that to some adults? And people are like, oh, no, you know, you would never do that. They just wouldn't engage with it. And I said, well, you know, maybe we just need to think about this a bit more critically, sort of thing. So quite often I think it's useful to think about different age groups and think about the age-appropriate kind of techniques, if you like, sort of thing. So I'm not saying that children are the same as adults, but it's just I think we need to think a bit more carefully about it, sort of thing. So one of the things that I often think about and this relates to it is your perspective on the role of young people or their place in society, you know, whatever your sort of perspective is on that, will influence the type of research that you do and the method that you use and the nature of your consultation. You know, so if you're top down and think that children should be seen and not heard, and we should do as we're told, and whatever, you know, your women sit them in alphabetical order and give them a questionnaire and tell them to be silent and fill it out, which I don't think would be very good research. Whereas if you think that, you know, children have certain competencies and knowledges and understandings, then you're more likely to go in and do a different type of research, you know, and you might even use adult research methods like focus groups or interviews or such like, which is what I tend to do. You know, so it's just thinking through that. Obviously, there are differences. I'm not saying that children are the same as adults, or that young people are the same as adults, but I think there might be more connections and similarities than what people sometimes initially think there is. You know, so in that sense, I think there is a tendency to think, well, we need creative and interesting methods and drawing, and we need to do like all these interesting things. Sometimes that works really well. Sometimes I find young people in particular find it patronising. It's like, I'm not in nursery school, I don't want to draw a picture, just ask me the questions if you want to know what it is. And likewise, I've had that with, you know, some people say it's good to have like a youth-centred research finding, so you'll have your big proper report and your journal articles, whatever, but if you have something a bit friendlier and more child-friendly, you know, and sometimes young people quite like that, but I've also had experiences where like, I don't want this, I want the real thing. I want the proper report that's going to the Scottish Refugee Council. I don't want this crap sort of thing. Also bear that in mind as well. So this all comes from my experience. And again, you might want to think about the relationship between the researcher and the young people. So again, there's this typology, and this is in the book that Katrina mentioned. Very kindly did a plug for, quite like that. So it's about thinking through, you know, what's your perspective on the relationship, you know, between the research and between the young people. You know, is it elitist, is it patronising, or are you moving towards more facilitative and hands-off approach where you're working with the young people or even the research is done by them, you know? And again, I'm not a purist when it comes to participation research. I'm not, it doesn't necessarily mean that the bottom of the table's the best, you know, but sometimes I think towards the top of the table you end up not doing very good research. So if you go in as the expert thinking, you know, all of you are kind of quite patronising and elitist towards them, I don't think you'll end up doing very good research, and I don't think it will be, you know, very meaningful, if you like. And I think some people end up in the well-meaning thing, which I find that kind of bugs me. That's the kind of, you know, is patronising, but it's well-meaning, and I think a lot of young people can see through that as well. You know, so again, I don't think there's a right answer here, and I'm not saying you should do a certain type of research, but it's just something to think through in terms of how we engage children and young people in research and what the types of relationships that you're seeking to foster are, sort of thing. And I mean, as an example, there was somebody in my university who'll remain nameless who was doing some work about children's relationships with the historic development of Ireland, and they wanted them to do questionnaires that they were going to send to the school and get the teacher to complete with the students, and I was kind of like, that just sounds really dodgy, because you've got no control over how the questionnaire is going to be, you know, questionnaire could be given out, and the teacher will say, everyone sit down, go to question one, and all tick A, you know, the teacher can tell you what to do. You know, so you're not there, you don't really have control over that. So again, some other things to think about there as well. Obviously, there are additional considerations that might be relevant for specific groups of children and young people. So there might be vulnerable young people. Some people might say all young people are vulnerable, but there might be young people with particular vulnerabilities, you know, in terms of their sexual identity, in terms of their social class or housing position, you know, family breakdown, such like. And I think there is a tension between protection and participation. So there is the kind of discourse around child protection, but then obviously if you're wanting to do interesting research and engage young people in a meaningful way, you want them to participate. Particularly for younger children, there's physical vulnerabilities about their physical size, you know, and their dependency on adults. But there can also be structural vulnerabilities depending on how you're consulting them and where you're going through, say through a school or such like. And there obviously are differences in terms of adult responsibilities, so there are some extra things to consider there. And again, disparities in power and status. You know, I'm a university professor and I'm 6'1", and in the faculty of research for young people, there's lots of power and status differentials going on there that you need to be aware of. And this is the point I made earlier, but a lot of the drawbacks also apply to research with adults. You know, so even if I was going into research, I mean, a lot of my work's with ethnic and religious minority young people, and if I was doing the same research but with adults, a lot of the similar power relations would still exist. You know, I'm a white man, and you know, I'm working at a university, I'm in an elite position and such like. So fine, there's probably more inequalities in terms of the work with children, but there's still a lot of the issues still apply to adults. And obviously when it comes to interpreting the data, unless the children are involved in that, and that can be really difficult to do, the power differences still remain. And the research makes the decision about what to include. So there are, you know, even if you're trying to be very participatory and involve the children, the young people at all stages of the research, chances are there's going to be points where they are not involved. And I'm always massively impressed when people manage to do this, because I've not managed to do it yet with actually the young people involved in all the different stages. So those are just some kind of caveats, if you like. So what I'm going to do now is to talk about a project. So as part of the HRC project that Katrina mentioned, we worked with young people across urban, suburban and rural Scotland, and this was a project about how ethnic and religious minority young people in Scotland negotiate everyday geopolitics, which is about basically everyday political issues that are international, national and local, and how these are negotiated by young people. In that project, we worked with 382 young people across Scotland. I think there was 46 focus groups and 223 interviews or something like that. So as you can imagine, the masses of data that we're still struggling to analyse. But as part of that, I worked in a lot of schools, and one school in particular that I've done a lot of research in, and I have quite, it's actually my old school, And although most of the teachers are retired now, there's one teacher who's the deputy head who taught me when I was younger and I'm now quite good friends with. So she set up a load of focus groups around the raising the school. And because we got on so well at the end, she said, well, what are you going to give us back? I said, what do you want? And she said, well, I've just ran around for like 2 weeks arranging all these bloody focus groups. And I was like, what would you want? I don't know, I'll give you anything you want. And she said, I want you to work with my class. She only teaches one class because she's got a bit of management position. I want you to work with my class and I want you to create a research protocol. I said, what do you mean a research protocol? And she said, well, I want a guide on how young people should be treated by researchers. And I said, well, right, okay, I don't really know what you mean, but, you know, let's just run with this sort of thing. So I managed to get some money from the university to help support this and fund this. And basically what we did over a course of, like, 6 or 7 weeks, I went in to her class. So there were, at the time, the kids were, like, 15, and this was, like, a religious studies class that they had every week with her. We worked with the class, we talked about research. You know, and some of it was led by Kath, and some of it was by me. And again, sometimes she had to actually cover all the curriculum that she was supposed to cover, and there might only be 10 minutes left for me at the end. And basically, we did a lot of different exercises around what research is, how they want to be consulted in research, why they find it interesting or not. And, you know, there were some focus groups and discussions and things like this as well. So I'm going to talk a bit about some of the things that the young people said. And then at the end, I can give you, I brought copies of these. So this is what the young people ended up creating. And it's called Get Your Facts Right, A Guide to Involving Young People in Social Research. They picked the title. And the colour scheme, they changed the colour scheme. So basically, I got some internal funding from Newcastle University to support this work. And then basically, it's got all the points in it from the young people about why they think research is important, how they want to be treated, how the research should be conducted, and how researchers should behave. Very interesting. So I'll talk through some of the kind of, I've got lots of pictures here about the that were generated in this process. You know, so we kind of talked about research and why it's important, and you know, there's lots of kind of flip chart paper and post-it notes and points been made here. You know, some of it was quite just basic about, well, what's the difference between qualitative and quantitative research, and you know, why would that be different? You know, and you know, stuff about emotions as opposed to like measurements, sort of thing, and the differences between those. You know, and it's interesting some of the points that the young people made. We do research to improve our knowledge. You know, so they already know quite a lot about what research is. You know, we do research to improve our theories. And again, these are all coming from the young people. This wasn't, I didn't really say very much during this process. You know, so there's lots of points about research. They actually already knew quite a lot about what it was about. This is a group of boys, not surprisingly, but they're right. Researchers, when you gather information in order to find out the answers to our questions and to prove our theories, they put across the top. You know, so again, you know, that's slightly problematically worded for somebody that's you know, a critical social researcher, but you know, they kind of get the point here. They probably know more than what a lot of people think they know. And then when they talked about different types of research, they already knew quite a lot about, you know, surveys, questions, you know, mind maps, textbooks, the internet. They kind of, they knew what this was about, it's like back in 15. And even one of the groups even had qualitative research, and they talked about interviews, focus groups, someone who sees a pattern. Right, you know, so this is, you know, some of the undergraduate students that I teach wouldn't be as good as this. Someone who sees a pattern, focus groups. And again, this was completely from them. This wasn't me, you know, interfering at all, if you like, with them. Survey, knowing the unknowables, I quite like that one. Research to study certain people, for example, why young people get depressed. You know, so they almost said, you know, they had to have a reason for doing a piece of research. So that was like one set of discussions, but then a set of discussions about how the young people should be treated by researchers. You know, so there's a lot of interesting points here. They want to be treated with respect. They want to choose when and at what time. You know, so they don't want to be dictated that they'll have period three on a Thursday. They want to pick when they would do it. They should be allowed to miss out questions. Again, that's standard ethical practice in research, but they were aware that they shouldn't need to answer everything. They should not be patronised, right? So they don't want to be patronised by people. They should be treated equally no matter the race, age or gender. They should not have a bad attitude towards students. And they should always have a choice to say no. You know, so again, you know, a lot of this, the thing that really intrigued me about this is a lot of these points are what you'd find in like ethical approval forms in the university. Like, I was quite gobsmacked that they were coming out with some of this stuff. You know, because sometimes I did say, well, you should have that, and they were quite adamant about it. And, you know, also you should have a chance to say, oh, well, yes, why should we take part? We don't want to, all right, okay, just checking. You know, so they were very self-assured about what they were aware of. And then the other way that I kind of verified this was through some focus groups with the kids that I then got transcribed and kind of went through and analysed in a bit more detail. So in terms, you know, just to kind of back up some of the points, so some of this was about how researchers should behave and how they want to be consulted sort of thing. And we also did a ranking exercise where the kids voted on the methods that they would prefer to be consulted in. And what was interesting about this was, ironically, even though this was a flip chart, they weren't as keen. They weren't as keen on it. They found it patronising. You know, yeah, some people would think that's quite a good thing to do. And I know now and then at conferences, people put flip chart paper up and you get to vote and things, and sometimes I'm like, God, here we go again. Don't know if anyone else likes that. So maybe the kids, I think, thought that. And I think one of the reasons they didn't like interviews, and this came up in the discussions in the focus groups, was they really liked focus groups because they felt that in individual interviews, like, the pressure was really on them. They had to know the answer, and they had to be able to answer. Whereas in a focus group, if they didn't know the answer, they could kind of go quiet, and one of their friends or their classmates might say something, and they could, yeah, I never thought of that, that's quite good, and they could kind of, you know, use peer support sort of thing. So that's interesting, because I tend to use interviews quite a lot, and that has made me question that maybe that's quite threatening to the young people in a way that focus groups are a bit more supportive. And again, a lot of them like surveys and questionnaires, which I think is quite depressing, but anyway, but that's the reality of the situation. But again, I just thought that, and again, this is only one class of like 25 or whatever was the class, so this is just gives you an idea, but I did think that it was interesting. In particular, the flip chart post-it note thing, because that's the kind of thing that a lot of people would use, that's seen as a bit more participatory and consultative, but actually they weren't particularly taken by that. I mean, it got some votes, but it was half as much as the others. And I think on this I gave them like three or four sticky circles each or whatever that they could use as they please sort of thing. So I just think that the outcome of that's quite interesting. And again, so then what we did was the kids came up with all the points, and then I then kind of typed it up more formally, and I went through and analysed the focus group transcripts and themed them into key themes, and then I sent these to Kath via email, and she got the kids to fill them out and score them and rank them so we could try and see, was there certain things that should come out, was there certain things that should come in. I thought that was interesting. Researchers should be university educated. That's what they came out with. I didn't mention that at all. And I was like, oh, but what if what if they don't have a degree? Well, they shouldn't be allowed in. So I said, okay. Researchers should have a background check they came out with as well, you know, which is normally a requirement anyway, but you know, a lot of these points all came from the students. And then finally there was some discussion about what should be researched. And this was partly about helping, because this school gets a lot of inquiries about research because they're quite ethnically diverse and it's in a reasonably deprived area of Glasgow, so it gets a lot of people wanting to do research in it because it comes up in a lot of the measures. And Kath, as one of the deputies, ends up being in charge of research, and she has to police who gets in or not. With some of the stories she tells me about how researchers approach the school is just awful. She does send some stuff to me now and then, look at this person, this is so rude, and she'll forward me their email. So do think about your approach if you're going to try and get into schools. So this was also to give her an agenda, well, what kind of researchers should we allow in, you know, what are the topics that the young people think are important. So again, here were some of the points that the young people come up with, you know, youth hooliganism, racism, gang fighting, teenage death, bullying. And again, sometimes ask them to rank these, so racism came up top here, bullying and abuse. gang violence, drugs, youth crime. So these were the things that they were coming up with. Career opportunities, stress and gender equality. Very good one, that, well, I like that one. Bullying, abuse, gender equality again. You know, so these young people are only 15, but they're quite politicised when you think of some of the things that they're talking about. You know, so when we're thinking about, you know, their place in research and how we should approach them, actually maybe they know, it's not so much that they know more than what we think they know, but also they're aware of things in a way that some people might not assume that they're aware of, sort of thing. You know, so these people are mentioned, these young people are mentioned gender equality and racism, sort of thing. So this then led on to the creation of this. I've got some copies that I can give out for you to have a look. has everyone got one? So this was the final kind of product. So what I managed to get some funds to bring the class down to Newcastle University, so they all came down in a bus and stayed in a hostel for the night, and we went out for dinner and stuff like that. And then they met the designer, as we called him, which was somebody who's a PhD student who's good at doing things like this. We called him the designer, and she was previously a teacher, so she was really good with them. And she kind of designed the layout and stuff like that. And we sent it to the kids and said, what do you think? And they thought that, so the quotes in some of the pages, they felt there wasn't enough, they wanted more quotes. They didn't like the colour because it used to be a kind of stronger green, and they thought that was potentially sectarian. You know, being in Glasgow with the Rangers and Celtic thing going on, so they wanted this to change. So, you know, Lydia, who's the designer, changed it to that colour, and they thought that was fine. And then they thought this last page just used to be a list of things, and we thought it would be a bit more interesting if it was something like this. So just some of the points that they said. But this kind of covers all, and all the young people are mentioned on the page at the start there. So this kind of covers all the points that they themselves came up with. You know, so this isn't really, you know, I typed it up basically. I was the administrator and sent emails and got the funding to do it. But all the points in this came from the young people. So this gives you an idea of what, you know, and again, this isn't like representative. This is a snapshot of a group of, you know, 25, 15 or 16 year olds in an inner city school in Glasgow, and how they think it should be treated by researchers and what they think the issues are. There, I think it gives you some insight into, you know, their view of research, why they think it's important, and how they want to be treated. So there might, some of this stuff might be of interest in terms of your network and some of the work that you're doing. So I'm very happy to say anything more about that. There is there is an article, there's a new journal, I think is in its second issue, called Research for All. It's an online open access journal. And we wrote a short piece about the process of doing this in that journal. It's in the first issue, which I think was out last year. And I think I wanted the young people to be part of the authorship of it. So I think in the end they were called the Student Research Committee or something like that is what they decided they wanted to be called. They didn't want to be individually named. So I think it's the Student Research Committee, and it's Kath Sinclair, who's the deputy head now. And you know, so they were a part of the kind of the writing of that, and they commented on it. According to Kath, they thought my grammar wasn't very good. believe it. So that's the kind of the process of doing that. So I'm very happy to answer any more questions or anything about that. Something else I was going to say that's just escaped me. Oh yeah, and the other thing, as well, just as a follow-up to this, the young people have presented this to Glasgow City Council. So Glasgow City Council have an education research strategy group that you have to get approval from to do research in their schools. And basically it's somebody who sits just below the Director of Education, and there's a committee with three or four people on it, and I think there's a head teacher and an educational psychologist and stuff on it, and you need to fill in a form and get approval from them. So Glasgow City Council now insists that all researchers use this. You know, so the kids presented this to the City Council, and the Director of Education came along. She was horrible. Oh, she was terrible. She was so bad. She breached all the rules in this. But anyway, so they presented it there, and they've also presented it to Education Scotland when they visited the school, and to Scotland's Children's Commissioner's Office as well. So we managed to get money so that some of the kids could come through and present it. what I've not managed to do, and it's probably too late because I think a lot of them have left, is to then track the impact that this has had on the young people. I am aware that one of the girls that's involved in it became quite political, and she's been doing stuff with Young Scot about the race equality work in Scotland, and she's quite involved in that, and has been emailing me invites to things in Edinburgh and stuff like that. So there is that to kind of go along with it as well. But I'll finish there, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter. That was a really, really interesting start to our day today. I'm going to hand over to the floor but to ask any questions to Peter.
Did you say that there was something online just towards the end of your talk to do with this booklet?
There's the actual booklet's online as well. I'm sure it'll come up. I think some. You've tweeted a link. There we go. Fabulous. A link's been tweeted. A link's been tweeted. That's quite hard to say.
For those of us who don't tweet, is there a website that they can?
Yeah.
Perhaps we can email the link. Probably.
Yeah. And then there's an article about it as well in Research for All, and in that there's a link. I think they might even have put a PDF of this up with the journal publication. It's a very short piece, it's like 3 or 4 pages, and it describes the process, but it's also got a PDF of the actual protocol as it gets named.
Any other questions from the floor? Daniel.
Well, thank you very much for that. I'm just wondering, the group, the kids that you worked with, was that a mixed ability group?
Yeah,
so for random,
it was a random class, as Kath would call it. It was like a form class or whatever you would call it, like the one registration group. So there was a whole spectrum in it, including a couple of really naughty boys who she had to like. It was actually, from a pedagogical perspective, it was fascinating watching her teach them. Because one of her tactics was to go and sit next to the kids that were naughty. Like, so rather than standing up the front, she'd go and sit. I was fascinated by it in that sense. So there was a couple of boys like that that needed, like, right, kind of firm hand.
Yeah.
Right through to, I think, some kids that are going to university. It is quite a deprived catchment in that sense, but, it was very mixed. And it was also ethnically very mixed. So there was 3 or 4 Somalian boys, about 5 or 6 Pakistani Muslim, about Glaswegian born kids that probably sound like me, and then I don't think there was any Central and Eastern European migrants. I think, so it was quite ethnically diverse as well. Yeah.
Jason, and then Peter.
I was just wondering, thank you very much, it was really interesting, but how we are sort of enable young people to take part in what we might conceptualise as social forms of knowledge, when at universities, I think the way in which sort of funding works and the way in which impact agenda works sort of very narrowly conceptualises knowledge as being belonging to the university, and then schools, and that's where we find out stuff.
Yeah.
And I just wonder whether you've thought, or how do we circumnavigate a very narrowly instrumentalised funding agenda and impact agenda that sort of says that actually it's the university's got the knowledge. Because that seems to be a really obvious sort of thing that we've got to tackle.
I agree completely. I would love to know the answer to that. I tried to get ESRC impact funding for this, but I was told it wasn't, I never got the funding, but that's the money that's held by the university, and I was told that this was like too local, so its reach and significance wasn't enough in terms of the impact agenda. And it was only Scotland, can you not cover England as well? No, like, well, no, it's just a school in Glasgow.
Yeah.
So all that crap came in. And I think it's very hard to get this type of work funded by the research councils, because part of the challenge with participatory type research is you don't know what the answer is. Whereas I think a lot of the research councils want you to know what the answer is. They want you to be really sure of everything's going to happen. Whereas, with this type of work, you basically need to be able to say, but we don't know what they're going to say. We have a blank page which we'll fill up once we've had the focus groups or spoke to them or done some participatory mapping. And I don't think that research funders like that. They want to know, you know, that you know what's going to be on the page. But then if you're doing it properly, you don't have a clue because you're like blank slate type of thing. So I do think that this work is, you know, doesn't fit into that. Although my one slight hope is around the impact agenda. Is that I do think that this work is more impactful than a lot of other types of research, and actually maybe if more senior managers in universities start to see that, then maybe this type of work will be given more, you know, if it doesn't get external funding, it might get internal funding, or it might get supported in other ways, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do think that, you know, 10 years ago something like this would just be dismissed and kind of, you know, well, that's just an engagement with schools. You know, we'll put that into the, like, the kind of student recruitment stream or something like that. Whereas now, because of the impact agenda, you know, this gets profiled in the university and one of the research institutes keeps mentioning it and stuff. I think it's because of the impact agenda. So I think that we could be turning a corner, hopefully. Fingers crossed, eh?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the ideas, first of all. But also, in terms of what you've produced, you've highlighted that particularly 15-year-olds are capable of producing really quite mature ideas in terms of functioning of group dynamics. I was wondering, did you look at any other age groups, or have you considered any age groups to see how those dynamics change? And particularly, say, moving on to sixth form, where we see a lot of mature trends emerging in GCSE-level students, some of the sort of social confidence that displays itself in focus groups for GCSE level students may actually be clawed back or may retreat for sixth form. I was wondering if you had any experience of that or had any involvement in looking at different age groups and the way in which we're not necessarily looking at a sort of a progressive continuum, but actually sort of a wave rather than a progressive straight line. Because from a teacher's perspective, you feel that you have to really change yourself in terms of the way you engage with different age groups. And a summer holiday can make a tremendous difference to the way that you have to engage.
Interesting. I haven't thought, most of my work's with 16 to 25, I would say. This, and the HRC project is 12 to 25, so I tend to work with like high school age, young people or university, college age. So I can't say much about younger children. I mean, there was some interesting points in the HRC project about how the young people handled racism, for example, and how that changed. And what I noticed was when they were like 12 or 13, it was just a bit of a joke. But some of them, when they got to 15 or 16, they either became really politicised about it, or some of them got violent. And that was they kind of took it out in an aggression type way. It ended up being interviewing two kids, but it was a Muslim boy in another school in Glasgow who was sick of racism, and he was just going to kick the shit out of anyone that said anything to him. And I said, "All right, is that your best solution?" He said, "Well, no one else listens, so I've taken up boxing." And I was like, "All right, okay, you know, how's that going?" You know, and I kind of chatted to him about that, and that was his solution. You know, so some people might see that as a less positive response, but I'm not aware of there being a big dip. But then I've not necessarily looked at it in terms of progression. If you see what I mean, I tend to just look at their actual experiences at the time. And I suppose there is. I've noticed amongst, because we're writing a paper now about, and this is specifically about racism and Islamophobia, when the some of the university students, university age, so early 20s. Some of the young people were either become very politicised, you know, they would start, you know, they'd join the Labour Party or another political party or the SNP or whatever, and they would, you know, involve in the student union, become very politicised, or they would withdraw completely. And it tended to be either or, there wasn't much in the middle. You know, so there was examples of people saying, "Oh, well, I just don't say anything in university seminars because I'm the only Pakistani Muslim, and I just know if I speak up, particularly in politics, people think, you know, X, Y, and Z to me." And it was almost they kind of quieted down and withdrew. Or some of them became very vocal and very politicised. So there was some differences there in terms of the response. Although that's not really answering your question. I'm kind of skipping around it. I'm not, to be honest, I'm not, I don't think I can answer that. I've not looked at the progression and the dip thing, but I'm sure that's there if, from what you've said.
I was just going to ask a question and then we'll go to Susanna. I'm going to abuse my position as chair. One of the things I've come across, Peter, I'll just go back to your slide with the young people saying that surveys, questionnaires were their favourite, and you said, oh, you know, it's a bit disappointing. And I totally get what you're saying. I just wondered how you deal with it as an academic who is producing high-quality research outputs, how you deal with reaction from your academic peer group when they see that your methodology has perhaps involved surveys. I've just noticed in my own work that there's a bit of a sort of, oh, you use surveys, you know, as if it's discrediting the work that I've done, even though I've been trying to do focus groups and other sources. But if this is what the young people feel most comfortable responding through, then how as academics can we justify this to our perhaps sometimes snotty peer group, perhaps?
I do think there's a bit of a snobbery around research methods. Like, you know, you've got to some sexy new method, and if not, it's like, you know, because I get that sometimes in focus groups and interviews. It's like, oh, they're not a bit passé. Like, everyone uses focus groups and interviews. And I think, well, what have you got a better idea? You know, and then people don't say anything, actually, when I say that. You know, but quite often, you know, I get that with undergraduate dissertation students as well as PhD students as well. Like, well, but everyone uses interviews, you know, should I not do something different? I was like, you can't keep on, but interviews are really good in terms of a data source. Can I not do participatory theatre? I was like, you can if you want, but it's probably really hard to do. You know, so I tend to talk through the alternatives as a way to justify, you know, one approach, and also being able to say, well, this is what the young people wanted. I think there's a really strong justification that people have struggled to counter as well. And I mean, the other thing that I have tried is quite often when I do research, I have a demographic kind of survey anyway. You know, it's like 2-pager about their age and gender and ethnicity and all that. You know, so sometimes with this group, I'll say, well, look, I've got a survey and an interview. You know, so it's not a survey, it's just a quick questionnaire, but I'll use it in a way that, you know, that they're kind of getting what they want, but I'm getting what I want as well, something. But I do have a bit of an issue in certain academic circles. I do think there is a thing that, oh, you know, surveys are very, like, 1980s or whatever. You know, surveys can be really useful, although I tend not to use them. Surveys can be really useful just in the same way that focus groups and interviews and census analysis and whatever can be. You know, so that's the kind of thing I would probably say.
Susanna?
It's actually very briefly on the survey questionnaire point. On our project, we'll be heavily moving to involving pupils next year, a little bit more about that later. Let's just say, anecdotally, when we talk to the teachers that we work with in both the primary and secondary sources, we've had an indication from them that pupils may well quite like the survey questionnaire approach, I suppose. So that's just kind of come anecdotally.
And I have to say, on the survey questionnaire thing, the other thing that came up in the focus group discussions, and it turns out, I've worked out that this survey is actually the Scottish Health Survey, and the kids hated it. They had to write their name in the front, so they were all saying to me, but why should we write our name in the front? It's supposed to be anonymous and confidential. Right, so they got a wind up with that, and then, you know, and some of them were like Pakistani Muslims, and there's questions about how much alcohol they drink. They're like, I'm not going to have my name in the front, you know, Mohammed, whatever, and then admit that I have a couple of vodkas on a Friday night or whatever they have. Right, so they were kind of like, so they just make up the answers. They just like play around with it and like put in jokey answers. Yeah, you know, lots of health people are analysing this, like it's a series data set. You know, so there is that big caveat around surveys, you know, and quite, and the kids say they're quite often pulled into a room and, you know, and they're sat down and told to be silent and have to fill in this survey. They don't know what it is, nobody speaks to them or briefs them about it. They're supposed to write their name in the front, and they're just like, you know, some of them like almost make up things as a part of it. You know, so there is a big caveat around surveys when you hear stuff like that as well. So I can't wait till I hear somebody's presenting using the Scottish Health Survey so I can come in with a question about that and say they've carefully analysed data over the last year, basically made up. But anyway.
I think we've got time for one more question, Ian.
I was just going to ask you. You know, the kids talked about the fact that they get lots of surveys, or if it's, so we, you know, we teach video games, so, and surveys are a great way of getting feedback from players, but, you know, we often get students telling us that they are fed up of surveys. you know, but you can't interview enough people, and you can't, I yeah. can agree, it's like, I'm just wondering if the kids feel that, because obviously survey fatigue is something, we tend to send out surveys for, you know, even at university for student modules, there's the national student survey, there's all of these things, and at school, my wee girl came back, she's 8, and she's like, oh, I had another survey to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's a big issue, and a big issue is how long they are as well. There's one thing having a survey with 5 questions that you can answer in like 90 seconds. It's another thing if you've got like some big boring health survey that's like 25 pages or something on it. So
we,
I think there's...
We find survey monkeys really good for that because the feedback is
limited
only
10
questions.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally. That's. I would be inclined to go in with something shorter. You know, because I just, and especially when you've got the school environment and, you know, the teachers are under pressure to cover the curriculum, actually doing a really short survey with 10 questions, I think it's the kind of thing that you might get better responses, might be more rigorous data. But I do think there is a thing about over-consultation as well. You know, I mean, this school, they constantly get requests from researchers all over the UK because they come up in a lot of the, you know, if somebody does a search based on deprivation or ethnic diversity, then this school comes up. You know, as the school that you must go to. So, you know, they're always getting emails from, you know, Edinburgh Law School, youth crime surveys, and God knows what, you know, everyone wants to go in. And, you know, if there's a new population, so the recent, there's the Central Eastern European migrants and the Roma, well, the kids wanted to be called Slovakia and Czech Republic and or Roma, they didn't want to be labelled Roma. That group, so suddenly a group of researchers were researching that and they wanted into the school. So there is that sort of, I wouldn't say it's survey fatigue, it's research fatigue. Mm. You know, and especially if nothing happens from the research. And that was something interesting to ask the kids about, is, well, what do you want to be told? You know, do you find out? And they didn't like the Scottish Health Survey because it happened and then they never got told anything about it. Whereas, you know, they said even just a sentence. And I said, all right, so if somebody comes in and does a big survey, you just want a sentence and feedback? Yeah, that would be fine. A sentence saying what they found out and whether it worked or not is what they said, but they don't even get that. You know, so I mean, I did feedback to them, and I spoke to one of the school in service days, and you know, and it went to the senior management team of the school and all that. But I think that part of the fatigue is that they don't get feedback, they don't get told what happened as a result of the survey or whatever it was.
Thank you.
Really
good.
Thank you very much, Peter. I think you've got us off to an absolutely flying start. Loads of questions going through all our heads, I think, about reflecting on how we conduct our own work with young people. And thank you in particular for speaking to us when I know you're not feeling 100%. So can we give our recognition to Peter? Thank you very much. Thank you also for keeping to time so brilliantly. We have lots of time for questions, which is great. We're going to move straight into the next panel. We've got a 5-minute cushion now, but I think that's useful to have on a day that's so packed. So I'll just invite the first panel and the chair to come on over and get set up.